My name is Russell Jackson. I'm the editor of Predictive Modeling News, speaking this morning with Jim Sheehan. He's New York State Medicaid Inspector General. Mr. Sheehan is formerly with the U.S. Attorney's Office and is an expert in health care fraud. Good morning, Mr. Sheehan.
Good morning, Mr. Jackson.
Time with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Looking forward to it.
You mentioned in a recent presentation that Medicaid calculates each state's payment error rate. Does the program use statistic sampling to do that? And what kind of modeling tools does it use to determine payment error rates?
Okay. Medicaid currently, that is the federal Medicaid organization, which is the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services Medicaid Integrity Group, and that uses a system which is a very traditional system to determine error rates. Essentially, what they do is they take a statistically valid sample of claims over a given year, quarter by quarter, and they then analyze each of those claims and require records from the provider to support the claim that was submitted. So this is your old-fashioned sampling methodology, and the calculation is based upon standard statistical analyses.
Right. Are there any specific tools that the Medicaid program uses, you know, state by state, or are there any particular types of sort of red flags that the sampling looks for? You know, does a certain type of provider carry different weight than a different type of provider? Does a different geographical region, have different factors that go into determining how big the sample is, how you extrapolate from that sample? You know, any of the nuts and bolts that are program-wide or state-by-state?
Well, let me just walk through the CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, was required to develop a national protocol, and it uses a stratified sample based upon the dollar value of claims. And so there's not a lot of magic to that, and you may say it's not the perfect system, and some states have been more aggressive about trying other modeling techniques, but they're both expensive and relatively novel. So that this is pretty much the state of the art for the federal system as it stands, and since each state is evaluated based upon their performance in the payment error rates, the standard methodology becomes very important.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned as well that Medicaid conducts program integrity assessments.
Right.
Does it base the assessment on the existence of systems to prevent and detect fraud, or does it base the assessment, you know, of whether a program is adequately has adequate integrity? Does it base that on the results? You know, does it go from if your institution goes from 10 to 6? That's what we're looking for, or whether it went from 10 to 6 or 10 to 9 or 10 to 11, the fact that you're making the effort is what the program looks for. How does that break out?
Okay, let's walk through it. This is a classic Donabedian-type question, and right now we are in Medicaid and to some large degree in Medicare on compliance in the structure and process phase as opposed to the outcomes phase. And it's only in the last year that we've started to see mandatory compliance programs for healthcare providers. And New York State's will go into effect on July 1st. The federal one is, there's no required compliance program for many Medicare providers. So the first step is the structure. What is it supposed to look like? And that structure is more of a consensus model than it is a data-driven model. What I anticipate over the next year is that we will be conducting reviews of the compliance programs that are in existence in New York State and say, okay, let's see what the best practices are in each, which, again, is pretty early in the analysis. The better compliance programs that are out there are already conducting their own integrity assessments internally. But when you look at these things, predictive modeling is a relatively new discipline as far as compliance is concerned. And one of the problems we've had in dealing with that is that if your unit of measurement is improper payment, that's relatively straightforward and can be determined. If you're looking for if your unit of measurement is fraudulent acts, much, much more difficult. And so what we're looking for and looking at evaluating these institution or provider systems is looking for improper payments from whatever source. the traditional tools that have been used by compliance programs are primarily sampling and audit. And we anticipate that the tools are going to get substantially better. But here's the problem. In New York State, we have, for us, that is for the Medicaid inspector general, we have a database of $200 billion worth of claims over 5 years and 66,000 providers and, you know, enough very robust data set that lets you do a lot of things with it. When you start to drill down to much smaller, much smaller universe for each facility, the predictive ability of the data becomes less. So we're trying to figure out a way or a number of ways to measure the effectiveness of integrity programs that allows them to use data tools. We found it to be more difficult at the micro level.
You said that expected severity of sanctions is not a predictor of compliance.
Right.
What is, and how does the Medicaid program determine what is? How does the program decide if we put these sanctions in place, we'll get this enhanced level of compliance, whereas if we put these sanctions in place, we'll only get this expected level of compliance? What kind of modeling tools do you use to make those determinations?
Okay, and again, you're hitting us at the very beginning of the process in terms of designing these tools. I'm confident from my law enforcement background, looking at both the research and my own experience, that the actual severity of sanctions does not predict compliance in any way. So then you go back and say what will you do? First, you got to figure out what compliance is and what your numbers look like, and that's what the PERM, the Payment Error Rate Measurement Program for Medicaid, is designed to do. The second phase is to look for variables that you can measure, which will tell you something based upon your experience of what you're going to find. So let me just walk through, and you can stop me if I ramble on too far, but what we look for are five different kinds of data. The first is provider data, and one of the predictors of compliance is financial difficulties. The more difficult the situation the provider finds themselves in, the more likely that you are to have compliance risks.
Mm-hmm.
The second area is patient data, and we look to a variety of characteristics of those patients to determine, including their interaction with certain kinds of providers, to determine both is there a risk for the patient, and is the second is what kinds of providers are those patients likely to interact with. So you have a provider predictor there too. The third is CPT data, obviously the data of procedures actually done. We've been doing that for a very long time, and there obviously are procedures that are much more predictive of problems than others. The next one we look to is ICD-9 codes, the disease codes. And these codes, again, allow you to sort based upon experience and based upon other interactions, the kinds of disease conditions which are likely to lend themselves to fraudulent activity and also improper payments. And the final thing is integrating demographic data available from other sources with the data we have that's already built into our claim system. And so, for example, where you find disconnects,
mm-hmm.
where you have data, the data in one system, in our system, says the patient is a male, and the data from the outside says the patient is female. The data in our system says the patient is healthy and alive. The data from the outside system says the patient is dead. And then you've got to work that back into looking at specific providers. So, for example, if I find a particular – one of the tools we've started to use is not just which patients are dead, and we used to just ask for the money back, but looking to providers who seem to be billing us more frequently for dead people than others.
Mm-hmm.
There are default diagnoses that will appear in ICD-9 data. So if we know the default diagnosis, we know we have an issue. There is other types of invalid data, for example, with respect to pharmacies. And so you look to see a geographic impossibility, for example, or not impossibility, but highly unlikely. So if we see a pharmacy that shows that scripts are being written by people who are almost, average 100 miles away from the pharmacy, that is extremely unlikely unless it's a mail order. And I could go on this, and I'm not sure whether you want the 30,000-foot level or the detailed ones, but I can
this
do either
is good. One. What you provided is exactly what people listening to this will want to know. One of the things that the Medicaid program would like provider institutions and individual providers to do is something called routine identification of compliance risk areas.
Right.
What kinds of predictive analytics does the Medicaid program hope that providers will use or encourage providers to use to be able to do that so that they're looking for the same kinds of compliance risk areas that the Medicaid program is, so that you're all reading from the same sheet?
Okay. Well, what we historically what we've said is go read our press releases, which is if you look at the compliance guidance that's been given out over the last 10 years, it is a compilation of areas in which law enforcement has found problems. We're trying to become more sophisticated about that in New York and to say what kinds of specific facilities have what kinds of issues. So I've talked about pharmacy, and pharmacy of all the areas that we handle lends itself most effectively to data mining and predictive modeling, because with every prescription you've got a prescriber, a patient, a standardized product, which is the drug, and a pharmacist. And so you have four different data points for every prescription, and any one of those can yield significant amounts of information. So if I was looking at a pharmacy, I would say, well, are you running a DEA number data screen against the prescriptions that you're filling? And if you do that for all your stores, you're going to find these issues. Are you running a pricing screen against all the prescriptions that you're filling? And a lot of these are, first you're putting them in as a screen to say, are you in compliance? But the second is, when you put in a screen for the first time, you find out which units of your organization are most problematic. And that gives you an area to focus on. The next thing that we look at and think about is quality scores. There are a variety of quality scores, primarily now for hospitals and nursing homes and managed care organizations. And there are two kinds of quality scores that worry you. One is a group that is consistently bad, like special focused facilities for nursing homes. And the second are quality results that seem to be too good. So, for example, in some downstate hospitals, they have not identified and reported a pharmacy error in a year, right, in the entire hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of data that's too good to be true. So you want to take over. At that point, you think there's a process weakness in terms of the reporting.
Mm-hmm.
So when I look at each of these issues, we do an audit plan every year as well, and that's based upon our assessment of the weaknesses in the program. And our expectation is that if you are a compliance officer in an organization, that you will run the audit subject areas against the data that you have. So, for example, one of the areas that we're looking at is DRG code pairings. All right,
mm-hmm.
And we can tell you which kinds of code pairings are problematic. So, for example, if every patient in a hospital is admitted with a stroke as compared to a transient ischemic attack, so you'll have the typical hospital, the TIAs are about, let's assume it's 30%, and yours is 10%. That's an area that you want to take a closer look at.
Mm-hmm.
But code pairings are a perfect example of the kind of thing we're talking about. And failure to report is another example of the kind of thing we're talking about, which would suggest that you have a compliance program weakness.
Let me ask a final question, and this is the one where we ask you to gaze into your crystal ball and tell us what new areas that may not yet be thought of as conducive to predictive modeling applications or areas in the Medicaid program where predictive analytics are currently being used that could be expanded in the future. What sorts of predictive analytics applications do you see for the Medicaid program moving forward?
Okay, one of the ones that we think is going to be very significant is a focus on the ordering practices of physicians. Historically, what we have looked at is the claiming activities of physicians. So the doctor bills for a level 3 office visit, or they bill for a lab test or whatever. I think we're going to see a lot more focus on physicians as the fulcrum of the system. That is, what is their role in ordering services and quantities and outcomes and so forth. The second thing that I think is going to be significant is a renewed focus on the patients and their relationship to specific providers. So you look not just at claims for Dr. A and the patients in his system. You look at the relationships among the various physicians that patients see and the various patients that physicians see. That's difficult for a facility to do on its own basis because they don't really have access to the data. But it's possible for us to do, and the question is how you communicate that. To go back to the ordering physician issue, that's a significant area, not just for quality of services and outcomes and cost, but it's also an opportunity to look for potential referral relationships in terms of kickbacks and improper payments.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sheehan. This is exactly the information we're looking for, and we will look forward to working with you again very soon in the future.
Mr. Jackson, thank you very much for inviting me.
We'll speak to you soon.